My name is Catherine Barnett, and I'm reading the poem Envoy. I was trying to look a little less like myself and more like other humans, humans who belonged. So I put on a skirt, purchased in another life when I had a husband and wrote thank you notes and held dinner parties. The skirt even had its own little pocket, and the fingerprint stains yellowing the fabric were almost invisible. Nothing to be ashamed of as I walked past homes and faces with their welcome signs and their no trespassing signs. I was hoping to look domesticated, or at least domesticable, that I too could walk the trails and then return home, stretch out beside another human, and watch something on a big screen until it was time to sleep. I too had veins at my wrist, and I'd read Maslow with his hierarchy of needs. I remembered that love and belonging were pretty basic, and that at the top of the pyramid was transcendence. Late that night, I took off the skirt and lay down on the kitchen floor of a house where years ago a boy and his girlfriend overdosed in the basement, a fact I try not to remember. There used to be a cross staked outside beneath the blue spruce that died when the place was abandoned. Because I am afraid, I left the outside light on. Halogen burns hot, so bright it must have stunned the imperial moth shimmering against the window screen. Most moths would rather spin around lights than mate, which is all they are put here to do. And sometimes they just tire themselves out flying at night. This one was disguised as an autumn leaf, though it was only midsummer. Size of my hand, as much enigma as legerdemain, very temporary. At most, she would live a week. Something about the way she waited there, wings outstretched, still as a flat lichened stone, made me want to rescue my copy of Maslow from the basement and study the hierarchy again. In the diagram, I saw sex at the very bottom, along with eating, drinking, sleeping. I wondered if that meant it was foundational or optional. The moth vibrating there in the circle of light seemed to be choosing transcendence over other basic needs. Imperial moths have no mouth parts. They don't eat. They make no sound. In the morning, I buried her under the ghost spruce as cars sped by. Before I tossed the dirt back over the shallow hole, I took a photo to prove there really was such a thing as an imperial moth, to prove she wasn't alone. Wings made of iridescent chitin, arranged to look like leaf litter. In the dirt, she glowed a little.
I'm Elizabeth Scanlon, and this is the American Poetry Review Podcast. Hi, Hannah. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Hello.
Here we are again. Where do we begin today, guys? What do you think? We know we have a new issue. We have this gorgeous, beautiful March-April issue with Catherine Barnett on the cover. So that's always a good place to start, unless, you know, you have other things to catch up on.
I have all sorts of big questions that came out
question.
Of reading the magazine, but also on my walk over here, I was thinking about our resolutions. I don't know if they're resolutions, our goals.
Uh-huh.
And mine particularly was to read a book, which feels unbelievable,
okay,
right?
Yes.
And I think that I partially filled it. I just want to report that I started and really fell in love with the book. And
okay.
Then when the semester started.
a book that is completely non-required reading that you're not doing for,
wow.
for preparing for a class.
And I will get back to it.
Okay. What is it?
At the Atoka Station, the okay. Ben Lerner.
Oh, great.
And it's really kind of amazing. I think I might be the only person in the world to describe that book as sweet. There's this one section, I'm going to ruin part of it for you all.
Great.
Where the narrator has just been discovered to have lied about the death of his mother for attention.
Mm-hmm.
And the response from everyone is, oh no, something must be terrible in your life to to do something so weird.
Right. Yeah.
And I just found it so touching that people's response wasn't, you liar, you terrible person, but instead, oh no, sweetie, what happened?
Who hurt you?
This definitely says something about my life more than anything.
Well, good on you. I'm glad that you're getting back into the swim of things with novels.
And I also started reading a really, this is like an impromptu, you know, the best things in the world segment. I started reading 100 Poems to Break Your Heart, which is a great anthology by Edward Hirsch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And boy, it's like, can everybody start writing these poetry anthologies just like this?
Mm-hmm.
It's 100 poems and a 3-page essay about it.
Right. And so like concise, to the point, doing what it set out to do.
Yeah, something very helpful. I've heard Hirsch talk about poems different times. Once at Breadloaf, I heard him talk about We Feed They Lion.
Yeah.
And now I understand that poem.
Yeah.
I always knew I loved it, but now it's like with me, right? So I like the way that Hirsch writes about poems a lot. And,
absolutely.
Bringing in just the slightest bit of biographical information to help you out. Anyway, so that's another that's another thing. But my big question, to get back to the point, is why am I more interested in slow and boring poems than I used to be?
That is an interesting question. My first clarifying question is, what makes a poem boring in your estimation? Like,
see, there's so many places to go with it. I think that what I'm talking about particularly is a poem whose voice is not at the core of what it's doing.
Right. And it's not expressing excitement or heightened emotion, you mean?
Yes. And at the same time, it's selfness speaking for itself is also not the core. Like it's like it's not masked, nor is it bald.
Gotcha.
It's just, it's just there.
Right.
It's like, here's a poem.
Right.
And that's actually, and I hope that this is not a disparaging comment at all about Catherine Barnett's poem Envoy that starts the magazine. That's where I was right away. I was like, okay, I'm going to look at this poem that says, I guess in a poetry class, I would talk about abstraction versus narrative. It's almost entirely narrative. It makes its point very lightly.
Right.
And I think that that's part of what I'm talking about, too, is that we don't spend a lot of time in the abstraction of what we're talking about. We spend a lot of time in the story and building the tension.
Right. Yeah, I think that there is something... there's something to what you're saying that to me sounds like maturity.
You know? Thank you. I knew it.
That's in there somewhere, Stephen. I know there's something, but, which is interesting that like, I think culturally we sometimes respond to that as being like, quote, boring, but like what it has more to do with is that like, it's fascinating to explore someone else's thought process in that way that is not being like over-dramatized, right?
Yes.
As one particular or possible sort of response to that. What do you think, Hannah? Like, do you find the more sort of thinky poem as opposed to the feely poem appealing?
Yeah, I really do. Yeah. I really loved this poem, Envoy, that starts this issue. I don't know. I liked that the sort of like statements of this poem are like sciencey or like factual, like about these moths.
Right.
Sort of like that's where you get the most like sentencey like statement.
I do love like an evidence-based sort of,
you know, as opposed
like a science
to like
element, right?
As opposed to like poems that I also love, but that have like a something that is they say is fact, but is like very much not fact, you know, but it comes off. It's like this is like incontestable and like grounding in a way where those other sort of poems that hinge on a big statement. I'm trying to think of an example, but
it's okay.
Yeah. That hinge on a big statement that is just the poet's own sort of assertion. Right. It's not based in anything.
Well, I mean, I would say for
of
example,
the world,
that like,
exactly.
Right. Like I would say that, you know, Frank O'Hara, of course, I think is a touchstone of like,
totally
the, like the exuberant poet, right? Like the exclamation point, like the, like just the bursting forth, like with, you know, declarations,
and,
right?
And yet when I read this poem, by the way, we just have to give you a little bit, two things. One, there's a lot of gesturing going on in the room, which nobody can see.
Two, I talk with my hands.
The first line, the first couplet of this poem, and I would say it's in, it's like 500 couplets are in this poem. I was trying to look a little less like myself and more like other humans. So I don't know that we can exactly say that there are assertions in the poem that are not false.
Right. Well, but also that aren't funny, because then that line follows on that. Humans who belonged. So I put on a skirt. Like, honestly, that made me laugh. Like the first time I read that, I was just like, you did what now?
To be more like a skirt. And then later on in the poem, there's thumbprint sized stains on the skirt, which are not too noticeable, I think. and then we were moving along and talking about these moths, and you'll have to figure out how. And we get to the fourth from last line, to prove she wasn't alone. And there's this great loneliness to the poem. All of a sudden, and we're not going to make a big point of it, but you know, that going back to the beginning, I was trying to look a little less like myself and more like other humans. What a lonely and funny thing to say. Maybe it's more correct to say that we start with the humor in this poem, and we just slowly whittle our way down to what it's like to be human.
Right.
Which I do think
is... And the
is,
sorrow that is like kind of underneath the thinkiness. Right?
That's so much of what I go to poems for, is to see what other people's lives are like in a, you know, I think that's why we go to cafes, you know, to look.
Right, to observe.
I go, how are you dealing with this situation?
And yet it's so interesting, I mean, not to be like such a, I don't know, person of my age, Gen Xer, whatever, but it is still noticeable to me that when you go to cafes, like there is so little space there where anyone's not looking at a screen, right? I mean, most of the time. I know certain places like don't let you use, you know, your laptops or whatever. But most of the time, if you're in a city and you're in a cafe, pretty much everyone has
a laptop. It's a WeWork, basically.
Yeah, right. And yet still, I think that applies though, because like you're still observing like what people are, what solitudes they're bringing to the space, you know.
I remember being in college and we sat there and you could tell, you know, how lonely everyone was by just looking around the room. And I looked the most because I was the most lonely.
Right.
But now everybody has their phone, and what a great shield.
Right.
Yeah.
How fantastic, right? You come in. And
this tool for exponentially increasing loneliness.
or shielding it, because what's worse than being lonely is being found out.
Right. Being, being obviously lonely, except in poetry, where it's kind of one of our major topics, right? I mean, I think.
Where you flaunt your status, Stephen, as the most lonely. I've seen the ribbon. It's true.
That's right. King of the lonely.
I keep on trying to convince other people to not take the ribbon from me. It's mine.
But say more about this idea of like the boring poem or the slow pace. I think I would prefer the term slow-paced. Right? Because boring has a negative connotation, even though I don't think that what you're saying is negative. Like, I think that you're responding more to like a tempo or a mood.
I guess I have to talk about myself a little bit. When I wrote as a younger man in my 20s and 30s. Well, I think in my 20s, I had no concept of what the reader was looking for. But in my 30s, and I think spurned on
well, but how
some
could
level,
we ever know, right? I mean, no. I think that like you can't.
It's a problem too.
Yeah. I don't think anyone can write to a reader, right? No. I mean, it's like one wants to engage, like, and be engaging, but I don't think that it's possible to like to say like this is what the public needs, right? Right?
I think you can write to a slush pile reader, and that's a little bit more cynical. Mm-hmm. But I think you can. I think you can start to think, especially you know, reading submission after submission. At some point you go, okay, when something catches your attention in a particular way, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's particularly interesting and you can kind of run with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's necessary for young writers because you have to get your foot in the door mm-hmm. and you have to tell people what you're about. Mm-hmm. And then later on you can kind of say, okay, I'm going to write, a page and a half long poem
right.
that goes about its business slowly. You're totally right. Boring is not the thing.
Right.
But the attention grabbing coolness.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Is the other side of the pillow.
Gotcha.
The other side of the mask, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hello. My name is Omotara James, and I'm reading my poem, Ruthless. Who was the first fat woman you loved? For me, her name was Ruth. She was soft and generous with her body, by which I mean she hugged me when no one else was there to cross an arm around me. She would let me hug her when I was exuberant, when I was sorrow, when I was scared, before and after I'd done the wrong thing. With Ruth, the answer was always love and more love. When she hugged me, I felt luxurious as velvet, adorned in head-to-toe velour. I was not afraid to be seen or held. I was grateful not only for Ruth's fatness, but for how she carried it. Carried it. Words that were regularly spoken to me as a child. As an expert carrier, I was grateful for our discourse of bodies, for the outer petals and composure of Ruth's mature flesh. I, the awkward shoot, all stalk and burgeoning. The flash of acceptance between us was a creation story, an invisible home I carried on my back long, long after. I wore her absence like a heavy magician's cloak. Yet, I do not ponder her whereabouts. For even as I hold myself today, I feel her glow, a dark chiffon. Her glimmer, a velveteen shine. Who would I be if Ruth had never hugged me back into myself? I wonder about that girl, half-bitten by toxic masculinity, already half-gone down the block, steps beyond the open, wading back into what the world would have heartlessly imagined for me. Ruth, first confessor of my small secrets and trespasses. Ruth, second carrier of my burdens. Ruth, who demonstrated her worth by protecting mine. My breath so steady in her arms. Ruth, who chased after that half-hardened girl with the bloody rock, sharpened by her own hand.
Another poem that really caught my attention in this issue is Sunday Versus Bruce, Queens, New York, August 2023 by Omotara James.
So, yeah, I love these poems also. Omotara James is new to me. I had not ever read her work before reading these poems, but then just received a copy of her new book called Song of My Softening from Alice James Books, and wow. It is spectacular. It is really, really lovely.
This poem immediately reminded me, in a way that I'm sure I'm wrong, about C.K. Williams. Mm. Not just the length of the lines, but also the gas station.
Yeah, I was like, I don't think you're wrong about that. I think that yeah. there is. I think there is a like a comment. There's an energy there that's, yeah.
And it's interesting that you mentioned O'Hara earlier, because I kept on thinking with both of these poems, Skylar.
Right. Good one. Yeah.
And there are certain element. I hate when people say things like, what is it?
Tell us what you hate, Steven.
Oh, I hate so many things. People will say, like, it just sounds like speaking, or what's the terrible term that people say?
Conversational? No.
like a speakerly text?
Stream
of consciousness.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Right? It's like up there with flow for me. This has
a stream of consciousness is one of those terms that I think that people mean to be a compliment,
sure,
but actually sort of sounds dismissive.
It sounds like boom, right. You hit it with the first try and then you walked away.
Right.
This has a certain conversationalness to it, but it's very intentional with its craft. Mm-hmm. And it ends on you can be a foreigner in your own hometown, mm-hmm. which is, again, getting back to the idea of the narrative versus the abstraction. Mm-hmm. That's the point. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of my second big question, which is, what are we looking for
from poems? In poems?
Yeah, what are you looking, like, not as a magazine editor, but, like, why do you go?
That is the big question, right, Stephen? I mean, I think that between that and what is a poem, like, those are the questions that kind of keep me in it, right? Is mm-hmm. that, like, it's compelling. Why is it compelling? I still don't know. But we love to kick it around.
Well, my big thing, and I'm speaking way too much, but my big thing is...
No, never.
I feel like as a writer... I've always sort of wanted to cultivate a line between being sure of that answer and unsure.
Right.
And I think the reason, and if you're too sure, then you start becoming a parody of yourself.
Yeah.
And if you're unsure, you fall off of a cliff. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been over the cliff for some time now.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I'm sorry. Intrigued.
I agreed too enthusiastically. Yes, yeah, you're over the cliff.
She's read the drafts.
I love it.
No, but but I think that one of my answers is I come for your truth.
Right.
Mm. You know, and and I love these two poems together, where one is working towards that truth. Mm-hmm. We're gonna get it at the end. And the other one starts with that truth, and it's just the whole concept of the poem is that it's gonna open it up mm-hmm. for everyone else. It's two different strategies, almost the inverse of each other in ways, but beautifully enacted in this issue.
Right. I mean, I think that if I were to just posit a theory about, like, what do we want from the poems, I absolutely feel what you were saying right there as well. But I think that to me, one of the most important things about it is to see how someone thinks, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that as a human being, I certainly feel mostly mystified in the thought processes of others, right?
Sure.
Like, every day of my life, I'm like, what was that person thinking? both in the frustrated
or
sense.
Or, like, that's how people move through the world. People move through the world like that.
Right,
like,
right.
Yeah.
But it's like that, as much as that is an experience of frustration, it is also an experience of wonder, right? And the more I feel like I have an insatiable appetite for wanting to understand that, or not mm-hmm. even understand, maybe that's the wrong word, but wanting to, like, peek in at it, you know?
I think it expands our lives to see the ways that other people think through life and move through the world and
connect dots and
It's very helpful when you meet people on the street to go, oh, that's right. You may just be a poet.
Well, you know, I mean, it is spring, and I feel like here we are in the very early spring, and that there is a thing that happens in poetry, certainly in American poetry, where I feel like there's such an abundance of poems about spring or that reference spring, but when you really start to like dig down in them and, you know, just bathe in it, most of them are misery.
Yes.
Or like most of them aren't like rejoicing in spring. Most of them are about profound loneliness or about, you know, longing.
Right.
You know? And why is that? I mean, that is another... That's another one of our big questions, right? I mean, of course, it's a cliche to say April is the cruelest month, and that is why it's Poetry Month. What do we make of like the poetic relationship to spring?
Well, I mean, I think people still are like in dusting off the shackles of winter or whatever, like as they're writing those poems. I think that there hasn't been that forgetting that happens when you get to, you know, summer or fall even. Mm-hmm. Like I find springtime poems to be more miserable than fall poems.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I think, I mean, as poets, are we just more comfortable with the idea of loss than we are with the idea of regeneration?
Of rebirth.
Yeah.
Well, wait a second. I guess I'm imagining how completely a poem that was happy and was about being happy would lack dynamics whatsoever. Like, it's interesting when someone writes...
Name me a happy poem. I mean, I'm sure they exist, but...
Happy poems are interesting when someone is deciding to be happy or working against impossible conditions to be happy, right? If somebody comes along and goes, I'm happy because, you know, my bills are paid and everybody loves me and I'm handsome. Yeah. And, you know,
snooze fest,
right? It sort of lacks a certain perspective. Right. So when we talk about fall poems, the whole world is dying and we're reaching for life. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about spring poems, the whole world is coming and we're reminded.
It's the counterbalance. Yeah. That's a good point. I think that there is an impulse. There's a poetic impulse to like want to go directly
be the other thing.
Yeah. Right. To the prevailing energy or to the presumed correct response. Yeah, I get that. I'm a contrarian too.
Yeah.
I mean, also there's that Americans are liars.
Wow, Steven is coming in hot today. Yeah.
Say more.
Okay, so really my first thought was that I think that there's something about being an American that is the agreement that it's great.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm proud to be an American. No.
Wow.
It's
not...
It's not.
And so much of, I think, being a country that's about arms dealing is about the agreement that we're happy.
Right.
That it's good. It's good that we spread.
Right. And that it must be protected at any cost.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
No, thank you. I'll take the fall or the winter, you know, or the summer when it's so sweaty and drenched and uncomfortable. Give me all of those. Take the spring back, America. That's America's season.
Oh my God.
Season of the liars. I'm just writing a poem.
I was going to say, I think this is now turned into a composition. There's a draft coming.
The season of the liars.
The season of the liars in America.
Trademark.
Good stuff. This is Fritz Ward reading from our March-April issue.
What it is. Love is the Mariana Trench. Fatherhood is the tilt-a-whirl, the gravitron, the scrambler. Motherhood is the honeysuckle and the havoc. Childhood is the mansion we haunt. Love is the way we detonate each day. Tuesday is sacrosanct and snarl, its pollen gussing up the sidewalks with green. Tomorrow is the mystery machine hot-wiring the Holocene. The heart is a sea anemone. Love is the felony. Your mother is your mother is your mother. Life is the strawberry patch we dust with blood meal. I'm the man planting peonies, offering you answers without promises. You are the cherry bomb of tenderness. I'm the man calling to the Congress of crows in the sweet gum above. You are the sour tang of life fermenting. I'm the carpenter in the coffin guessing it's Halloween, my heart hemorrhaging into the dark. You are the promise and the answer and the waves of forgetting. You are the God-sized ocean demanding our devotion. You are you, no matter what I am.
This has been the American Poetry Review podcast. Thanks for listening. You can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads.